It was really hard for me. I mean, it was, of course, it's just really hard in general, but I didn't have really the capacity fully to show up. I really didn't. And I would now, but I didn't then. And it was in my late 30s. I was very scared of death at the time, very scared of losing him, and also just watching the disease move through his body was, it was just, it was devastating on so many levels. And he started becoming a bit more dug into his spiritual practices. He was a meditator. He was just very contemplative and became more and more so. So I felt he was already starting to slip away before he even died.
Hello and welcome. My name is Liz Gleason, and you're listening to Shapes of Grief. Shapes of Grief is a curation of stories from international guests who share their unique experience of grief. These stories are shared with the wish that you, the listener, may find some comfort, hope, and solidarity, and maybe also the realization that you're not alone in your grief. Each time you listen, please do support the podcast by donating on the website shapesofgrief.com or by becoming a patron on patreon.com. It's a privilege to hold these conversations, and I extend my deepest gratitude to all my guests for showing up in this particular way. It truly is a gift. Welcome back to Shapes of Grief. And this week I'm joined by Adriana Marcion in San Francisco. Adriana, you're very welcome.
Thank you so much, Liz. It's wonderful to meet you and to be here.
I'm really looking forward to our conversation today, one arts therapist to another. You're an art therapist, I think, and I have a background in drama therapy. So it should be an interesting conversation.
Yes. Well, it's technically the term, and I'm not sure if it's as familiar to you as expressive arts therapy, and multimodal and the base of my work is movement and dance, but I also do performance and creative writing and some poetry as well as visual art. So it's a combination of many things.
Lovely. I know of at least three expressive arts therapists we have here in Ireland. They're actually an Israeli couple.
Oh, wow.
But we don't have a training in expressive arts therapies here yet. Somebody might bring it someday. But yeah, I really look forward to speaking with you about this because I certainly work a lot through the body when it comes to grief. Yes. And it's nice to meet somebody else who comes from a similar perspective. So could we start maybe, Adriana, with your own story? I know that your husband died a few years ago. Tell us a little bit about him, please.
Well, he was such a powerhouse. He was a fiery person. We met actually, gosh, it was so long ago now because he passed in 2007. And no, was it two, yes, 2007, gosh. And we met, gosh, 12 years before that, I think, or even more, 14 probably years. We met in recovery. We both were in recovery from addiction. And I just was drawn to him right away because he had such a, just, he was so generous and warm, and he had just this charisma, right? He had this charisma. But he was 20 years older than I was. So, you know, I was attracted to him, but I thought, he's a vision of a man that I would love to be with as I was reshaping my life, but he's too old. So he's not the man that I would be with, but he's a vision of a man that I would love to bring into my life as a partner, lover, friend. And gradually as I got to know him and just felt so just really like there was just a kindred spirit, you know. He was a jazz musician. He had this deep sense of creativity. He was very poetic. And we just got a rapport over time. And I had been dating some other people and just really didn't feel like it was fitting for me. And I just started feeling this deep love for him and actually pursued him. And we started dating, and it was just this incredible romance at the beginning. You know, just, it was so, it just felt really passionate, and he was so loving and present with me. And he also had kids, so I had these two young kids that all of a sudden became a part of my life as well, which at the time was very fun for me. Little did I know, you know, of course, becoming a stepmom is its own challenge. But he had really a huge, big, generous spirit.
And you had 14 years together, you said, and then what happened, Adriana?
Yeah, well, we were together. I mean, I knew him. We were together really for 12 years, but there was a couple of years that I felt like we really were connected before that, right? Before we started dating. So yeah, I think you could say it was 14 years that I knew him. And then I'm exacting sometimes the years, right? And after we got married, and actually after we'd been together quite a while, and then 2 years into the marriage, he started having a serious cough, and there were things going on with his health that just were concerning. And I kept saying, like, you need to go to the doctor. And he was very stubborn, just very stubborn. And just, he was always in great health. So, and he did yoga and all this, you know, was just ate really healthy. And so he was just very stubborn about it. And finally he agreed to go. And pretty quickly it was clear that he had something going on with his lungs, and he had a biopsy, and we discovered it was lung cancer. So it was a 2-year battle for him of fighting lung cancer, which is, at the time, I think it's maybe a little better now in terms of treatment, but at the time it was still really hard to know if he could survive it, right? And we thought at one point that he was going to get through it, because he had been so dedicated to his treatment. And then, boom, it just went really fast when things started going downhill. And then he passed away in 2000, like I said, in 2007. Yeah.
It's interesting you say there that we thought he'd come through it because he was so dedicated to his treatment, as if we have something to do with it.
Yeah.
You know, sometimes these things are so much bigger than anything that we can do.
Yeah.
But we do that, don't we? We try and figure out ways to beat it.
Yes.
You know, with all this battle language that we often use, fight it, beat it, be strong.
Yes.
Oh, yeah.
Yes. Yes, it's so true.
How was it like getting that diagnosis? Do you remember for you? How did it impact your life?
I remember, relationships are so complex, right? And we had been going through a hard time together. He was experimenting with ayahuasca, and you know, we were both in recovery, and it's interesting to talk about it because it was so secretive at the time. So it feels like people doing ayahuasca and psychedelics, and it's just very much in the world and so talked about. But at the time, especially because we were both in recovery, right, it was very taboo. And I was upset about it. I was very upset with him. And I thought, well, how could you do this? It felt like a betrayal. And I also felt very concerned about his recovery and his sort of slipping into old behavior. But for him, it was this something that he really longed to do, to have that, go into those altered states, and it was very spiritual for him. So it was interesting because we were just having this tussle, and again, we were fighting a lot, and I felt very conflicted about how to manage our relationship at the time. And then boom, like, he gets the diagnosis. And I remember really significantly when he got the call, and just how, where I was in my room where I did work, and my office in the house. And I just remember just vividly that moment where everything shifted, everything changed. And it was also a coming back together for us too, because it just put it all into perspective. It was not just about, you know, okay, our fights around this situation that was happening. It was a much bigger, everything was at stake in a different way.
Yeah, much bigger perspective comes in, doesn't it?
Yeah.
It's a matter of life and death.
Yes.
Do you feel that his using ayahuasca and the psychedelics was a threat to sobriety in your home?
It did feel that way. It felt like a threat to sobriety. And also, to me, I was not, he actually even encouraged me to consider doing it. And we were seeing this spiritual, we were working with this spiritual mentor, and she also encouraged me. And I just felt very confused, and it threatened my sobriety. It felt like it threatened his sobriety. Mm. But I mean, in the end, I think he did end up stopped taking it and just really fully committed to his treatment and kind of came back into the fold of his recovery in a different way. Mm. But I also felt that there was something about that experience that helped him in the dying process as well. So I really, over time, came to terms with that as something that maybe he needed to do, something maybe he was tracking, wisdom beyond what we both could experience in the moment.
Mm. I'm curious to ask you about this, and I hope you don't mind, but you know, when we go into recovery for addiction, I mean, we become addicted to substances or behaviors for a reason. And often there's a trauma or complex trauma or very sensitive people. The world is just too much and we need something to buffer us from feeling so much. And, you know, there's that vulnerability. Like we talk about this vulnerability after loss, after grief, after bereavement. And I think there's a similar vulnerability after in recovery as well. When we stop using, and I speak from experience as well here, it's that raw vulnerability that we have to learn to live with, which is very similar in some ways to learning to live with that raw vulnerability of grief. And I'm imagining, you know, and it's work. It takes work to stay sober and not to what I call play whack-a-mole. You know, you get on top of one addiction and before you know it, another one has popped up and it's like, I'll get on top of that, but another one shoots up and you combat that and something, you know, we find ways to compensate unconsciously a lot of the time. So to keep all those moles, if you like, in place, it requires a lot of work and a lot of engagement and a lot of commitment to ourselves, you know, to stay navigating the world while feeling intensely without whatever substance or behavior kept us from feeling intensely. Would you speak to that a little, Adriana, if that resonates with you or not?
Yeah, you're speaking my language. You're speaking my language, Liz. It's definitely my experience, and I definitely feel that in when I work with people, because I work with so many creatives and so many people in general that have struggled with addictions and with trauma and with grief, right? Because they're all connected in so many ways. When I first got into recovery, it was a whole new world. I had to reinvent myself. It was a big loss. You know, it was a loss of a coping mechanism. In many ways, people say it's a loss of a friend, that the addiction became this companion that was always there. It was always there to help you buffer against the challenges or against emotions or the world or the negative thoughts or whatever it may be, right, to navigate. And so it was a huge feeling of loss of the old life and moving into the new life. And it took so much time to figure out who I was and and that identity shift. And then also, like you said, that raw feeling of exposure, like all of a sudden I don't have that protection of the drinking, of that, you know, coping mechanism. And I'm bare in the world. Mm. And then when I went through grief, and not only did Eddie die, but a year later, my father died very suddenly. So it was this double whammy for me of not only, you know, just losing two very significant men in my life. And it felt so similar. Like I was a new, I was new again in the world. I had to reinvent myself again, and it just so disorienting. And how do I shape my life without these people that were there as pillars, as anchors? So it's, to me, it's exactly what you said. I mean, it's a very raw, sobering experience.
Hi everyone, excuse this brief interruption. It's Liz here, and I wanted to tell you about my grief training program. If you are interested in becoming grief literate or grief trained, I've designed a comprehensive online program which you can do at your own pace in your own time. It's been designed primarily for healthcare providers, but we all have a right to grief training and education. So if you're interested, then it's for you too. Sign up today at shapesofgrief.com. Now, back to the podcast.
Yeah, and it's interesting because I think a lot of people don't realize the losses involved with addiction, but also what it does to our bodies. You know, I speak quite a lot about the impact of grief on our bodies. And, you know, listeners will have heard me say this. One person that I interviewed, Linda, she described it after her son died by suicide. She said it was like my nervous system was on the outside of my body. And I know that post-addiction or in recovery, that was certainly a sensation I had. Nobody had died, but it's like, it doesn't have to be a bereavement that can bring us into this state of intense vulnerability and loss and, you know, needing to rebuild, needing to grasp at whatever fragments are still available to be grasped at, but rebuild ourselves to be able to exist without the addiction. So, you know, you'd already been through that, and then you lost two pillars in your life.
Yeah.
Having gone through recovery, do you think it helped you to rebuild after bereavement?
I do think it helped me in part because I had a really strong community.
Yeah.
And I developed that over a long period of time. And I already had been, gosh, I guess 15 years into recovery, around 15, 16 years into my recovery at that time. So I had so many people that supported me and surrounded me. I also had my family too, but it just right in the moment and the just day by day, people would check in on me. You know, people would, I remember, bring me meals at the beginning, and it was such an isolated, lonely time, even though there was a lot of people around. But there always felt like there was somebody that was present. And for me, being a part of recovery meetings and being able to lean in that way was just, it did give a lot of comfort. And so, and I knew because I'd heard so many other people talk about going through grief. I heard people lose their spouses or lose their parents, or, you know, I remember someone that had lost a child as well, I think soon a little before that had happened. And so just hearing them walk through it and all the ways that they found hope or solace or connection. So I think because of that, it did give me some support that I wouldn't have had if I hadn't already been solidly in my recovery and knew, like, okay, things pass and there is a light at the end of the tunnel, but I just have to keep walking.
Beautiful. And the importance of community, Adriana, the importance of having people around us. And it is, you know, it's lonely. Nobody else is experiencing what we're experiencing. We are on our own, but to know that there's someone just dropping in or available or that they care. Like I believe so strongly that one of the antidotes to grief is love, you know, just to know that we're still loved, even though the person that loved us most in the world has died, there's still love coming from other places. It's almost like a survival need, an emotional survival need. I need to know that I can still be loved.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think the antidote also for me to grief that I've heard many times is movement. because of the nervous system and the way, like you said, the way that we can shut down or we can lose our circulation, like everything gets cut off. And that's, I know how I felt in many ways. And I was dancing at the time a lot. I had been tango dancing at the time because I'd started that with Eddie. We had done that together. We even tango danced at our wedding. And I just got into it so fully. He didn't get into it as much as I did. And I actually was dancing before he died. I started dancing after he died. And that was a place where I also felt community. And I felt held through the dance. And I think I really needed that because it was this escape moment where I could step out of all the intense feelings and all the ways I felt very weak and exhausted and drained. And then I would go and I would dance for an hour or two and I would feel my strength and I'd feel healthy and I would feel like I could go into a different world and remember who I was separate from all the grief. So I really agree with you. Like there was so much love that supported me and there was a lot of movement and over time art, you know, art really helped me.
I love the idea of tango because obviously, you know, I'm an open floor movement therapist also. So, you know, I have an idea about what we're talking about here. But what I love about tango is it's contained, it's fiery, it's got strength, you know, it's got passion. And there's something about embodying that part of it rather than, say, going to just an expressive dance class or, you know, Five Rhythms or Open Floor where you come and you just dance in an uncontained way, your grief. There's something really nice about the containment of tango versus just expressive movement.
You got it. It's so, that is exactly it, Liz. I mean, I couldn't just dance openly. I remember I've wanted to do these expressive things I had always done or I had done in my work, which was more just more free form. And I kept feeling like maybe I should do some performance about this. Maybe I should just dance in my bedroom and or just do some of that again, just more what's it called? Like improvisational, right? Improvisational movement. And it was too hard. It was too scary because I felt like I would just drop into the abyss of all the feelings. So the containment of tango and the structure really supported me because this happens, then that happens. And then you dance with somebody for 3 minutes and then the song ends. And then maybe again, or maybe you dance with somebody else. And just, it was also the literally being held, and tango so intimate, you're pushed up against each other. And I felt that contact. It reminded me also, like, I'm still here, I'm alive.
Yeah. And I think also grief can feel so much bigger than us, you know, for whatever reason we're grieving or going through a difficult time post addiction or whatever, it can feel so big and so uncontainable. And something I hear over and over again is I'm so scared to open it. I'm so scared to let myself begin because people do feel I'm going to fall into this abyss, you know, and I'll often have people just kneel down on the floor of my office and say, feel that, feel the ground. If you fall, that's the furthest you'll fall. You know, feel the containment of the earth. Or even, you know, when you go home this evening, go lie in the ground in your back garden and feel the earth holding you, because it can feel like we're in free fall. That's what I hear from people. They say it's like I'm in free fall. You know, this psychic explosion has happened. But yeah, back to the body, it's really interesting, you know, because we know that grief can cause immense stress in the body and secretion of cortisol and adrenaline. And we have this often in the pit of our stomach, this feeling of anxiety, a tightness in the chest, and often it can make us frozen. You know, we don't want to go out. We're so vulnerable. We don't want to connect. We don't want to move. We don't want to leave home. Our social circle shrinks. Our comfort zone, our physical comfort zone shrinks. Yet ironically, it's often the antidote is on the other side of that for us. If we can reach out and connect, if we can find a bit of momentum to move, but maybe it's in sort of a contained, holding manner.
And you know, just as you were describing all that, it just felt so visceral, because I remember losing a lot of weight at the beginning of the grief for me. That time, just my stomach was constantly in knots. It was so hard to digest food. It was hard to eat, but I would eat. But I remember it just felt like nothing was holding, because I was so, there was such an empty feeling, and there was also such a frozen feeling. And I had to figure out, how do I just live here? Because my body is going through, my whole psyche is going through this incredible change and rearranging. It was such a rearrangement of everything. And I had to move. I couldn't stay where we were living. And it just, all the things that, that again, oriented me, or just the ways that it was like, it was the ways that I saw the world changed, right? So within that, I was just constantly trying just to, okay, you know, not fall and completely fall apart. And that, I mean, that metaphor of falling was really what I ended up working with a lot, that created an art performance that I did 5 years later, because I started really wanting to be curious about that idea of falling. And because I wasn't falling at the beginning, literally, right? I was really tight and being held, but actually I started practicing falling as a dancer, as a mover. I just started practicing falling and letting myself explore that as something that I could feel in my body. And then I also practiced being held, and I worked with a dancer, and we did a lot of like falling and being held and falling and being caught. And I did feel like I was caught again and again, and I was held again and again, mm-hmm. as I went through the grief process, because of my art, because of the community, and because of the other piece of recovery is I already had a very strong spiritual orientation. I felt really supported by that part of my recovery program. Is I meditated and I would pray, and I just felt there was something greater than me holding me during that time. And sometimes it was the birds that I would watch and feel very connected to. Sometimes it was the ocean. Sometimes it was just a feeling that I was going to get through it.
I've heard a lot of people talk about this, Adriana, the importance of nature, you know, whether it be mountains, forest, trees, there's great comfort in holding on to nature. You know, there's something just that's so concrete and so available and so steady when our own interior world is so, so shaky. To lie on the ground, to hold a tree, to walk in nature, there's something comforting and holding about it.
Yeah. Just simplicity too. I mean, when you were talking about movement and just, I mean, I had that resource because I'd already been dancing, to just go and dance. But I know a lot of people that would be, it's too much to do something like that. I mean, I know a lot of people that, like you said, the frozen feeling or the fear is really great, and having to shut down or isolate is the natural. It's like there is something very natural and important about that. But these simple things like being out and just feeling the fresh air, or being connected to the movement of the wind, and very simple ways, like I often help people and allow them to notice very simple ways they might be able to move, and simple ways they might be able to start opening up their bodies back into expansion versus that constricted feeling, and a little bit more open, a little less closed, but then it's okay to close again, right? A lot of permission.
It's curious. I used to work with a lot of women who'd experienced perinatal loss. So their babies had died, and one really common theme, apart from the self-blame, was a feeling that their bodies had let them down, or that they had done something wrong, you know, that their baby had died. And I noticed that a lot of these women, and young women particularly, were often just glued to the couch, you know, to the sofa at home, and had lost faith in their bodies and didn't want to move their bodies and were almost dissociating from their bodies. And I'm lucky to live in a really beautiful area. And I started suggesting to them, shall we walk while we talk? You know, and using metaphor and nature to, you know, to support them. And, but also by the end of our session, they'd use their bodies for an hour. They'd, you know, they were starting to find their legs again, starting to find their ground again. And obviously, you know, that the person needs to want to do that and be comfortable to do that. But it worked really well, because once they started moving in our sessions, then movement between sessions started to feel a little easier. I think just on a chemical level, when we have that cortisol and adrenaline coursing through our bodies, it needs to be moved. It needs to go somewhere. And I'd love to talk to you about this. Movement is one way. Some people swim when they're grieving. Some people walk or take up running. Some people drink or smoke or do drugs, obviously, as a way to suppress it. But other people turn to creativity and the creative process. How do I use what's in me to produce a poem, you know, to get this outside of myself? It makes it a little bit more manageable sometimes to put our grief onto paper in words or in visual format or in movement, or to create a video or a documentary with it. Would you tell us a little bit about your creative process? When did you realize this was something that was going to support you?
Well, I've been doing art since I was a teenager. I mean, before that, but really, I mean, I grew up with a lot of craftsy women and you know, both my mom and my father's side. But yeah, I started doing photography when I was in high school. And then in college, I became an art major. And so photography and mixed media, I did a lot of like collages and different experimented in a lot of different ways. And from the beginning, art was a way to express myself, but it also felt like I could channel something into it. And definitely I could channel a lot of that intensity that I felt as somebody who was struggling with addiction, that it was a place to put feelings, put emotions, express my outrage about things in the world that were happening. And I didn't really think of it as a therapy or that it was healing me, because I didn't have that orientation at the time. But then when I got into recovery and shaped a new identity, which is a whole other story because it took a long time to do that as a creative person. And I realized how art was very private. It changed. It had been more public, and I was exhibiting and I was doing it to be seen in a certain way when I was in art school. But then in my recovery, it was really a private experience. It was something that could just help me organize myself and organize my thoughts and feelings and experiences. And then obviously I started studying it and doing it as a career, but that took some time to develop then my own new orientation to, well, how do I keep doing that? How do I keep finding my own dynamic way of creating? And when Eddie was sick, I started a practice of writing a poem a day. I think it happened maybe a year before he died, and I just started placing all those conflicted and confusing and sad and fearful thoughts and into a poem. And sometimes it would be a longer one, sometimes a very short one, and that continued, I think, for a little bit after he died. But then I had this whole collection of poems and I could refer back to. And then after 5 years, I guess it was 4 or 5 years, I started really getting ready to do something bigger. I wanted to do something that, like a ritual where I could move and I could use the poetry and I could express myself. And so I started creating this piece that eventually was When the Fall Comes is the name of it, where I was practicing falling. I had a dancer that supported me and a choreographer that I brought in, and we really played with how the poems could be expressed through dance and spoken word and all the different ways I could fall. And so it became this wonderful exercise, and I had this great team of people supporting me. And then because I always have to do more, I decided, let's make a film about it too. Let's just go all the way and let's just bring all the mediums in. And so I hired a team to come and help me and create a film that I didn't have a lot of expectation about it. I just wanted to document the process at the time and hopefully share it with other people, because I knew that I wanted to do a ritual with an audience, but I only could do it a couple of times because it was such a deep experience. It wasn't something I could take on the road. I was like, I'm just going to do this a few times, but I want to document it as well.
And it's amazing because so many of us, when we're grieving, we're so terrified of falling apart that we hold ourselves so rigidly and so tightly, you know, in that parasympathetic freeze response. And you took it and went, okay, let's practice falling. Let's practice falling apart. Let's explore this. You oriented towards it. And ironically, in the going with it, in the surrendering to it, in the exploring of it, then it stops being something that scares you.
Yeah, exactly. And it felt overwhelming at times. There were times when it was a lot to experience. It was a lot of feelings came up at different times. The thing that was different, again, was that I had people holding me. I had people in the studio with me. I had people guiding me. I also had the structure of the piece that started developing. I had the poems that I could read and pull apart. And so the art process became a grounding force. And I no longer felt like I was just in the abyss, or everything was just, there was no boundaries, right? There was all this clear structure that held me. And then when I started performing it and creating the piece, and then started sharing it as well, it felt empowering. It was a really incredible and surprising experience that it felt empowering. Sometimes it felt fun. It felt freeing. And even going to the difficult, very raw, cathartic parts of the performance, there was a transcendental experience, or something that really lifted me and connected me to the people that I had lost. Like, it made me really feel Eddie, and my father was also a part of that process. He was in the performance and in different ways, and so it was profoundly moving for me. And then to have people witness and hear their feedback, all of a sudden it was a broader connection and a broader community to bring into the fold. So I really felt transformed by the experience in so many ways.
It's like you took this pain and you took it from inside of you and created something with it. You know, it's like you evolved it into something creative. What did people say when they saw it, when they witnessed this? You said when you heard people's feedback, what were the kind of comments that people, what did it do for people?
A lot of it was, I remember one person said something, it was interesting. He's like, this is your masterpiece. The way that he said it, it wasn't like, this is a masterpiece, because, you know, it wasn't grandiose, but there was something about it that felt that I had connected to the source. I had really dropped into something authentic. And that really resonated for me. And it felt so clarifying that the art was coming through in a pure way. So I think there was a lot of grief that came up for people from their own experiences, from their own losses, there was also people there that had known Eddie or known my father also. So they felt that there was something that was like a reverence or an honoring of who these people were. And people, I remember at the beginning of the performance, which is not, it's also in the film at the beginning, where I had all these cards that I dropped, and it was the cards really told a story about losing Eddie and all the things that happen when someone goes through cancer and starts losing their hair and starts losing their voice. And so I dropped these cards at the beginning, and I think it created this feeling of shock for people. I wanted to have an impact, but it also gave them I really had so much feedback from that specific opening. It also felt very again, cathartic, like they could just let their tears come. They could feel themselves in that moment.
Well, it's like you gave a voice to cancer. Yeah, I remember watching that piece of the movie, and, you know, we all hear that someone has cancer and that's sad and what are they going through? And it's such a lonely, isolating experience, and people have no idea really what someone else is going through when a loved one has cancer. And the way you did that, it was just naming it. This is exactly what it looks like. Your hair has gone. Well, maybe you could say some of the words that were on those cards, Adriana, would you? What were the words that were, when you say cards, it's like a sign in your hand.
Yes,
you stand
yes.
They're wordless with these signs, and you let them drop one by one. What did they say?
Well, it started with describing just a few basic things about Eddie. And I think it's, and our relationship, I think it started, I'm trying to remember all the specifics because there was so many, there's so much that the story that it told. So it started with, I think, lover and partner, and then it went to jazz musician and cook, you know, great cook, and just different things about who he was. And in the background, in the actual performance, it didn't have it in the film because we couldn't use the song. We had a song by Nat King Cole called Love. And it's a very classic song that was playing in the background. So it was this contrast of this really upbeat song. And the words, you know, first it started like, oh, relationship, love, you know, here's this person. And then it started going into, you know, cancer diagnosis and metastasized cancer, and, you know, again, losing the voice and losing hair and just the different things. And then finally, I think at the end was being on a ventilator. And, you know, so those kind of, that journey was told in a very fast way. And even though it was a long process, as we know often of going through this, sometimes people have very sudden losses, but with cancer, it's always usually a process. But I just went through it in a very quick way, which in some ways we feel that shock over and over again. And so that's what I wanted to portray there.
And you did that beautifully in the film. Can I ask you about Eddie's treatment, like just jumping back a little bit, Adriana? And you spoke there about him being on a ventilator at the end. And I know from watching your film, you know, you talked about some of the treatments and some of the things he went through. What do you think, how was that experience for you to see a loved one go through so much treatment? And I'm wondering, did it feel like you were prolonging Eddie's life or prolonging his death? What was it like for you?
He was very clear about how he wanted to do his treatment the whole time. And he started with acupuncture and herbs, and it was very, just, he wanted to do it in a very natural way at the beginning. And his daughter was she'd been training in acupuncture. And so she was very, his older daughter, he had three kids, and she she was really supportive and really helping him and always researching different things he could do and all these smoothies of people helping him make smoothies. And I mean, there was a lot of community supporting him. And so I was on board with, okay, sure, let's try that first, even though I was a little concerned about if that would be effective enough. But soon after that, he definitely decided to go to the more Western, you know, interventions and began to...
There's no evidence for acupuncture treating cancer.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think that it was all very, I remember just going to with him to different people that had all sorts of ideas, you know, all sorts of ideas of what he can do. I mean, we live in the San Francisco Bay Area and there's a lot of, you can dig up anything here. But then he started doing radiation and then he did do chemotherapy. And then there was some different, they couldn't actually operate on where the tumor was because it was too delicate in terms of the lungs. So he couldn't actually have that surgery. So it really had to be taken care of through the chemo and the radiation. And again, like it looked like he had was getting better. And I was a part of the process for sure. I would go to the doctor's appointments with him. I was there with him through so much of it. But I also felt that, you know, he was just so determined and he was so clear and he had so many people supporting him, which was great. You know? And so it took some pressure off of me. And the last part of the journey, I mean, he actually did, he was, in the end, he was at home. So he did die at home. And it was really hard for me. I mean, it was just really hard in general, but I didn't have really the capacity fully to show up. I really didn't. And I would now, but I didn't then. And I was in my late 30s. I was very scared of death at the time, very scared of losing him. And also just watching the disease move through his body was devastating on so many levels. And he started becoming a bit more dug into his spiritual practices. He was a meditator. He was just very contemplative and became more and more so. So I felt he was already starting to slip away before he even died. And he also wanted a lot of people around. So there was a lot of people in the house and hospice was coming in. And I just kept feeling like I couldn't wait on some level until it was over. I just wanted it to be over and I didn't want it to be over at the same time.
Yeah. It's a painful, drawn out process for so many people. And particularly when we keep on prolonging, is it prolonging life or prolonging death? You know, it sometimes there's a question mark there. Treatment can be great for some people and it can absolutely cure some people of cancer. But for others, it can be just a really hard time buying more time. But what sort of time are you buying and at what cost? At what cost to yourself, your body, your own well-being and the well-being of those around you? You yeah. said you weren't able to fully show up. Mm-hmm. Where were you? What was going on for you?
It's interesting. Even as you say this, I'm feeling some of it right now. I feel the intensity of that time. And I just was pausing and taking a breath and feeling my seat and recognizing that the story still holds trauma, of course. And I've learned to compartmentalize it, right? I think that I've processed so much of it. I've done so much work on it. But I also need to keep separated from it in certain ways, right? Because when we go back into it, it can call back a lot of those disorganizing feelings. And so I think that's a lot of what it was for me. It was just very disorganizing. And I had two cats at the time. They've both passed since, which also huge grief for me losing my cats. I mean, one of them died not that long ago. And I remember them just tucking in with me, like at night, like they would surround me and lay next to me. And I even started sleeping. I remember I started sleeping in these different places. Like I couldn't sleep in our bedroom because he was in there. And then when he died, same thing. I just couldn't, I had to sleep in different spaces. So I'd be in my office or I'd be upstairs somewhere. I think sometimes I was in a sleeping bag, you know, just, I had to just keep finding different ways to feel safe and comforted because it was so, it was just so strange. It just felt like the whole world had altered so quickly.
You've made a really beautiful point there about dosing your grief or dosing your trauma. And I love that word, actually. I kind of forgot about the word dosing there, but it's come back. And sometimes we think we have to dive straight in at the deep end and writhe around in the agony until somehow it lifts. But you know, like with grief, it doesn't go away. We have to learn to grow around it and dose it, actually. You know, and it's if we submerge ourselves in it and don't let ourselves leave that ever, it's not helpful to us, for most of us. And I'm thinking dual process model here, you know, Strebe and Schutt, where they say a good grieving process is, you know, going into our loss orientation, feeling our grief, spending time there, but then also oscillating out and into restoration focus, maybe being creative, cooking a dinner, having a walk, doing something different. So, you know, dipping into one side, dipping into the other, dipping into one. And the back and forth of that is somehow what lets us process our grief. But I'm wondering a little bit there about, you know, when you say, just speaking with me, it's come up a little and you can feel it again. You know, do you think we ever heal from trauma? Or like grief, do we just learn to live with it in our nervous system? I mean, for many of us who've been through the whole cycle of addiction, there is a trauma that dwells inside our nervous system. There's a blueprint of it. And do we just learn to befriend it and know it and understand it and know how to treat it? Or do you think it ever goes away? Because there's so much discourse about trauma at the moment. Gabor Mate seems to be everywhere I look.
I know.
And healing trauma and treating trauma.
Yeah.
I wonder about all of this language.
Yeah, yeah. Well, and what you said about being in the deep end, I so often also use that metaphor. And the thing that I say to people is that we need to shore up sometimes, right? We need to go and just shore up and do the things that give us some soothing or some calm or make us laugh. And so that then we can tolerate when we're going to get, because we are probably going to soon get swept back into the deep end and have to tread water, because it's just part of grief. The waves come and we have to just hold on until we can, you know, move through it eventually. But having those moments to just really consciously say, I'm going to just go and take a break here, and I can actively oscillate, right? I can actively titrate my experience and get some, we need some control in a situation that feels so uncontrollable. And so I there was so many things I did, and just, there was just, I want to come back to your question, because I could go on for a while for that point of shoring up, because I think it's so important. But yeah, do we ever heal? I mean, I do think it's so different, right? That it's an evolving process, just like recovery. I still feel that I have that addictive part of me. I still feel like I could revert back and become lost in the disease again. I know that that's a possibility, but I'm so much more protected. I have so much more experience and tools and grounding that buffers me against that. And I think that happens with grief too, is that it's still the wound, the scar, the pain is still there. I mean, because the absence is constant. It's never, that's never going to change. But that time heals, the fact that I have tools, I have experience, I've been able to live and love. And again, all of that time does give me a buffer. It does help me know how to center back and land back in all the healing experience I've done. So I think it's both, right? I feel that, yeah, it's so hard sometimes to reconcile the reality that the loss is permanent. And also there's such preciousness in the fact that we have loved and that there has been so much connection to the people that are no longer with us, right? I feel that Eddie gave me so much. He changed who I was. I'm different because of him, and I'm different because of losing him. And the same, my father's, I feel, with me all the time, that the absence also, I was listening to a podcast recently about grief, and they were saying the absence is full. And I love that idea. The absence is full. And there's a lot that helps me just feel loved and also feel protected.
You say there, you know, about time healing, we tend to say it's what we do with the time. It's like, you know, you used your time to write, to create, to move, to catalyze your grief into something else. It's essential. Just listening to you there, Adriana, it's making me think of an ongoing conversation I have with someone who I'm supporting. And, you know, this metaphor of a river, like a raging river. And in the grief, it's like she's in the river drowning, can't get her breath, can't get her strokes, can't get out of it, is just experiencing this. And this is someone who is still grieving really deeply and profoundly 3 years later, all of the time, in a debilitating way. So we call it prolonged grief at that point. Someone who just really didn't want to go on. I just can't live with like this. And this metaphor of the raging river was really, really helpful. And it's like, there is a bank there. How do we get to the bank? And, you know, it took a while to work with this metaphor, but I remember feeling so happy the day she said to me, I'm on the bank now, and now I get it. I see what you mean about the river. I'm on the bank. I'm still wet. I'm still panting, but I've got a bit of perspective. So it's like she was suddenly able to talk about her grief, looking in on it, as opposed to always from it. So for 3 years, it was always from the grief, from the grief, from the grief. And it was just too much to bear. It was too big. It was too burdensome. It was too painful, too scary. But from the bank, she got a perspective. And it's like, it just because you crawl out on the bank, it doesn't mean you'll never fall back into the river, but you're able to suddenly recognize, drat, I'm in the river again. Okay, I know something about getting out of this. You know, I know something about learning to swim. I know something about being able to crawl out. And that's kind of what it's like for some of us in that grief process, is to recognize when we're in the water and to figure out, how do we get to the bank, to give ourselves a break? Yeah. You know, and the bank can be painful and wet and messy, but it's just not in that drowning place, that deep drowning place of acute grief.
And the power of metaphor. As I heard you say that, I mean, that to me is the power of imagination and metaphor and art, is that being able to imagine that even though I'm still in the raging river, that you can offer that, here's this possibility that you're sending a rope out, right? Here's this possibility of a bank, and you're not there yet, but maybe eventually we can get there if we keep imagining it, if we keep visioning it. And I do feel that art, and when I work with art and grief, is that I'm trying to help people think about those metaphors, like, what does the grief feel like? What does the pain feel like? And what metaphor is there? Where are you in that? And then how can your imagination help you shore up, or maybe find, maybe there's a bridge, or there's a place that you can rest for a moment, or hold on. And so I think that imagination that you're talking about in these, I mean, just it's so vast, right? The feelings are so vast. So anything to anchor, I think art really, again, anchored me, and it's so anchoring. And
it's I love that word, anchoring, and putting a sort of container on an experience that feels too big for us as well. And I don't think it works for everyone, but I think some of us, I know for me, metaphor works. It's like, okay, I get that. I don't understand what's going on for me psychically inside myself, but when I imagine the river and the bank, that really works for me.
Yes.
And it that's my story, and that's how I can visualize my experience, you know. And I know with a couple of my kids, I often do that as well. Use metaphor and story.
Yes.
And they can cling to that. They don't understand their internal experience, but they can cling to that metaphor.
Yeah,
and it can
exactly.
bring comfort, you know. I could talk to you all evening. It's fascinating.
Oh, it's been such a pleasure to talk with you. And so I feel so much, we speak the same language. We really do. And just, I'm really touched by your orientation and just the ways that you're holding grief. And I just really thank you.
Thank you so much, Adrienne. And I'm nearly at 100 episodes of the Shapes of Grief podcast, and there's just still so much to speak about, you know. And, you know, even as I'm like, what, maybe 8 years working uniquely in loss and grief, I've studied it a lot, and I'm still learning so much more. And I think it's as we, you know, as we integrate our own experiences and grow older as well, with different perspectives and a different understanding. Well, we've covered so much today. I'd love to do another episode on addiction and loss.
Yes.
Just that.
Yes.
Another episode just on metaphor and symbol and ritual.
Yes.
And if anyone's interested, I did write a blog piece on grief and ritual, symbol, and metaphor. And it's up there on shapesofgrief.com in the news section or blog section, right down a few years ago. But also you've produced two beautiful pieces. Would you speak a little bit about that just for our listeners, please, Adrienne, where they can find them?
Yeah, yes. So my first film is called When the Fall Comes, and you can find it at whenthefallcomes.com. And there is you can also watch the film through Vimeo. And so that's that piece. And then my current film that just is being released is called The Creative High, and it's 9 artists in recovery from addiction and how they're transformed by creativity. And that you co-produce that with I produced that with also Diane Griffin here, and a long-term filmmaker. And so a lot of them are Bay Area artists, San Francisco Bay Area artists. So yeah, and that's available at thecreativehigh.com. And people can find me also at adriannamarchione.com. And that has all the information about what I do and my work, teaching and one-on-one, and then my film. So everything's also there at adriannamarchione.com.
And I will share all of that in the description of the podcast so people can look you up. I definitely want to watch your other movie. And maybe let's put a date in the diary to speak about addiction and loss. You know, you referred to it earlier, all the things we lose when we stop using. And I'd love to delve into that a little bit deeper, because it is one of those disenfranchised griefs, you know. We don't talk about it, it's not acknowledged, and there's very little awareness of it out there in the world. So if you're willing, it would be lovely to talk to you about your new project and to talk about addiction and loss for another episode.
Yes, I'd be delighted. I'd love to keep the conversation going, Liz. It's been a very rich experience for me, and thank you also for just all your care and all that you do in the world for others.
Thank you, Adrienne. Take care now.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Shapes of Grief. This podcast is not a substitute for professional medical or psychological advice, And if your grief is making you unwell, please do see your healthcare provider. Once again, please consider supporting the podcast by donating on shapesofgrief.com or becoming a patron on patreon.com. I rely on your support to keep going. The music is performed by Baka Beyond, especially for the Shapes of Grief podcast. Until the next time, from me, Liz Gleeson, take really good care.
Absolutely gorgeous.